Lots of people here, but great. I think for this kind of audience. And I'll tell you, the title is actually Transport and Substorms, because I believe that the reconnection, at least in the magnetosphere, is closely related to the transport. And that's what drives the whole thing. And see that. And I'll tell you a couple of things which were done by myself and the people mentioned down there, mainly, not all, but I mentioned other names. And you know all this cartoon, which is very nice. And let me just start with the standard model. I think we have known this model for a long time, but it took us a very long time to verify it to some extent. For those who are older, then, you know that people argue about these chemical connections in your car. Do you really see it? In the beginning, I think the first conclusive evidence was really at the front side magnetopoles. The papers by Bachmann really at least saw the accelerated particles, and then more and more evidence came along, and now I think the break also took part in that with the polar data. We had already a very, very kind of microscopic, not down to the electron scale yet, but a microscopic picture of what can happen there. There's still open questions, but apparently it worked. It took a much longer time for the tail, because it's more difficult to look there. It's a more kind of dynamic system. But already for a long time, we knew that the IMF was important. There are other data. I just showed you something which I did about 20 years ago, I believe. And I was just looking at the electric field in the inner magnetosphere. And you look for 1,000 IMF. This is now plasma drift. The field lines are drifting sunward. But the northern IMF, they don't do that. Actually, if you compare very closely, this looks like the ionosphere, the ionospheric wind, not the solar wind driving the magnetosphere in that case. But, so that's fine. Taking the same kind of data now from cluster, it's actually taking data where you emit an electron, a couple of electrons, many of those, and they gyrate around the magnetic field, and when they come back, you see how much they have drifted due to the electric and gradient grad B drift. And this was the old EOS data that is now a better experiment of cluster. You now look into the lobes, and you actually see the field lines moving. If you look for the comparison before minus PZ and plus PZ, you see also for plus PZ they are moving a bit, but the length of the arrow is very short, actually zero in many places, while otherwise the field lines are really moving down, so you get this antiparallel field. Maybe you see the current sheet. You can even see, if you look just now from the other view, if the IMF has a BY component, you can see that the BY component of the IMF actually pulls the fields in one direction or the other direction, different in opposite hemispheres as you would expect. So that's all not a problem. The problem also doesn't really exist very much in the distant paper. If you look here, that's the velocity of the Earth streaming plasma in the tail from old IMP observations. And you see, if you look down there, like 35 to 40 RE, that's fine. It's about 600 kilometers per second. That's somewhere around the local Alvane velocity, as you would expect from reconnection data. When you get closer in, you see velocity just drops down, drops down, drops down, drops down. And that's not only due to the more intense magnetic field, because of course the electric field is important. That's what you map. But this is really much more. And the problem is, and also that's known for a long time, if you get such a volume, when you compress it to this volume, that's essentially what you do, if you connect the plasma in, you get a problem. You get an overpressure on the flux tube, and the flux tube just doesn't want to go in any further, it just wants to get out. The Erickson-Bolt stuff. There's one way, and or two ways to do that. For some time, you can just get a more tail-like field. That's fine, but that only works for some time. At the very end, what you have to do is you have to get rid of part of the plasma. There's no way around. That means you have to create a plasmoid and get rid of part of the plasma back to the solar wind, or the heated plasma. And, of course, that means you have to create an X-line. And this X-line was a lot of debate, and I think it was only about less than 5 years ago that people from the geotail team, actually that's from Nagai et al., actually really got a good chance to see statistically where the connection occurs. The reason was, in old times, we didn't have spacecraft in the right location. It was only GeoTel that was specially designed by, I guess, the Kida at the very beginning, and by his colleagues, to really flow through this region, 20, 30 RE, up to 40, down to 10, to really see where are the reconnections. These are all reconnection flows associated with substar montage. You see, sometimes you can even see earthward flow, tailward flow, and other times you only see earthward flow, the only tailward flow, depends where you are, because the tail is very dynamic. And as we later on, those flows are also kind of restricted in latitude and longitude. But on average, you can see there is an X line, and the X line, just by the flows, is around 20 to 25 RE. But there's still a lot of skeptics. You can always say you can create flows any other way. I don't believe that's easy, but I'll show you now some data from the cluster, which is probably much harder to dispute from the skeptics. And this is also a crossing of the four cluster spacecraft of an X line indicated up there. And you can see that if you look at the velocities, you see in the cluster barycenter, so we just took all the cluster data, average barycenter, and this is the X component, and it's tailward, then goes to earthward, and you see a couple of moments here, A, B, C, D, which will come up later on in the next view graph. So you look at the B up there, you can see the X is kind of coming down, you're crossing the neutral field, you're going back in the northern hemisphere, crossing back, and so on. And the nice thing is, of course, because we have four spacecraft, and cluster was designed to do that, by that four spacecraft, you can calculate vector derivatives. And as one of the examples, you can calculate curve B. And if you look here, then you see the curvature of B is this end on one side and this end on the other side, and it's essentially like you would expect the curvature of the field lines to be at both sides of the field lines. That's not all. In the last talk, we have heard something about the Hall electric field. We don't have an electric field measurement that can measure these kind of fields. At least, it is much more difficult to measure, but we can at least measure the magnetic field due to the Hall effect. And that is now why actually our, as we saw the situation flying through this kind of reconnection field. From here, there was A, B, Indeed, so we crossed the current sheet a couple of times with the fourth cluster spacecraft, and actually the current sheet was kind of bifurcated on both sides. It was not the maximum current density in the center, but rather off-center current density peaks. And there was even some indication that it might have been bifurcated in this region here, which would be kind of close to the diffusion region, but that was difficult, and we're still working on that. That depends, of course, the cluster separation. It changes from year to year, and this is not the best data to look at very much detail in this kind of region. But you clearly can see, if you look for the BY components from the different spacecraft, you see four different colors, four different spacecraft, they actually follow each other very closely. One side right here, the other side right here, so you see the quadrupolar field. And that had been seen also with the GeoTel spacecraft. But of course, there you can always argue that's one spacecraft, and you may mix up temporal and spatial variations. For cluster, all the four spacecraft thought the same thing. So there is, the Hall effect is important, or the decoupling of electron and ions in the tail.
Oh, why is this current sheet in the middle?
Actually, it's only, I believe, 500 kilometers, something like that. 500 kilometers. And that was a problem that we could not really resolve this current sheet, because during that event, cluster had a separation between the spacecraft of about 1,500 kilometers. So it was good to do this kind of studies, but it was not good to resolve the current. However, as you can see here, that's some new data which we just started to analyze from last year's tail parties. They always happen around this season of the year. And there, the separation was only about 200 kilometers. And now, if you look again bx and vx, so vx, the velocity, you see tailward flow first, then some no-flow part, and then you see earthward flow, and you see from the vx profile, you see you are on one side of the current field, then crossing the current field, several small crossings, go back, cross once more. And we selected two parts, one here, the faint blue stuff, and the second line, the other faint blue, and looked a bit more into detail. And now we could really use what people call typically colorimeter, just calculate the curl of B. And because now, apparently, you are with your spacecraft separation and the main scale of the feature you're looking at. Depends what you call quiet time.
No substorms,
No, actually, there are probably substorms, but we don't care about substorms.
Well, there's a lot of time variability, right?
No, there's always a lot of time variability in the case. Substorm, and I will come to that later, it is not the basic mode of operation in the tail. It's the basic mode what you see if you are closer to Earth. If you are in the tail, you see a lot of fast flows, called inversely bulk flows, or whatever you want, but that's the basic mode. Substorm is adding them all up. No, I think the tail always is very dynamic. There is nothing, there's not such a thing like a quiet tail. Only very, very rarely. You look that up, you're going up, you're at the current sheet, go up in the low, go back to the current sheet, go up in the low, and so on. So that's all within minutes, so that's all very dynamic. That's why you need the four spacecraft. If you have the four spacecraft, it's not so much of a problem. And what we can see in terms of current profiles, and that's now the JY, the east-west, the real normal neutral sheet current, that's put up there. Look at the profile. It goes up to 60 nanoamps per square meter, drops down, goes up. The center is here, and we converted that into kilometers by just following up, integrating B from low to low. And you see one profile. Actually, you see something like three peaks. If you look here, the next one, it's also something like looking like three peaks. So a bifurcated current sheet with another peak in the middle. And some of the theories working in current sheet actually like that at the present time. But more important even is, if you plot the same thing, and here it's plotted versus the Dx component, which is essentially kind of lobe is here, and that's in between. And you look at Jpeaks, that means that the current flowing towards the Earth or away from the Earth, essentially the field alignment, current flowing along the field line. Then you look here, it's negative, positive, negative. If you're on one side of the connecting here, then you're on the tailward side. So essentially, it flows out here, flows in the center, flows out here. If you look on the other side, it's on the earthward side, positive, negative, positive. Going along the field line again, going along the field line, going in. So that's essentially the whole current. And in the last slide, I told you the magnetic field due to the whole current. But now, with this small separation and being able to really calculate curl B, which would have been not good enough for the other one, because with a separation of about 1500 kilometers and the current field only 600 kilometers thick, here, the thickness of the current field is with about, look at that, that's 1,000 kilometers, so it's about 500 kilometers, is within the spatial scale of the cluster tetrahedron. You can do that. And you can actually observe indications of the all current system directly. Maybe just give you some the other ideas. Just, again, this is about, this is 30 nanoamps per square meter, so this would be 10 or 20 nanoamps per square meter in terms of current density. By the way, I think the highest current densities we have observed were about 120 nanoamps per square meter. We may still underestimate it because we always have to average over 200 kilometers. We can't say anything that there may be peaks even in between.
So if you observe the 100 ampere per meter, that means that thickness is thinner than the iron inertial lens.
Maybe.
Is that okay?
could well be that the structures inside there sometimes may be smaller than the ion inertial length. So it could be that you're really seeing a clear electron current or something like that. We really just started with that kind of things. So we haven't compared it very much with the other scales. And I think there was we even looked with some other people just in a very rough sketch to compare ion and electron velocities. And we couldn't do it really quantitatively yet. But qualitatively, it was also okay with the measurements done using the magnetic field. And this is then kind of another example what you can also do. There's not always a real need to fly through the reconnection region. If you have enough spacecraft, and there was kind of a cluster, even here, and here, down here, you can look at other things like look at the beam of particles coming, you can measure the electric fields, which are difficult to measure directly in the reconnection region, at least for the experiments we are using here. And you can also see the same things and just see a picture of the reconnection region down there. I don't have time enough to go into detail, but you might have a look later on the web. But I want to go a step further inward. And that's now a bit more older data. I think we did about 10, 15 years ago. That is actually a solution to one of the problems that some people from somewhere in the middle of the United States claim there's no flows in the magnetic field. And we doubted that. And it turned out there are lots of flows in the magnetic field, only they last only very shortly, and the instrument had an integration time of a couple of minutes, so they never saw that. But that was one result. But the more important result is those flows are always, at least in the inner magnetic field, say out to 20 RE, those burstwork flows, always are very bursty. They last, this is kind of a very average picture, something like typically not more than 5 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes. And even within that, there's a lot of burstiness in the flow. That's different from the more distant tail. That's different from the flow outward to the tail. The tailward flow is very open, not so bursty, longer lasting. And the other thing, which is also important, is you look at the magnetic field elevation, and then you see it's increasing during that flow burst. So the magnetic field turns from tail-like field to more dipolar field. Or essentially, it's those flow bursts which bring dipolar field in. So essentially, what comes about is you have a reconnection line here, you're getting flow in, and you're converting the flux with it in, and you're adding up more and more on this kind of inner boundary, which is typically like 10 RE, which is really the more dipolar inner magnetic field. And you're breaking this flow, you are diverting it, you put up pressure gradients because you bring new material, new plasma, new magnetic field in. And as in we have shown, and I'll show you some more results on that, that this is essentially what creates the subsonic current wedge, what creates the aurora.
Can I ask you a question about that data?
Yeah.
Just to go back to your picture. Are you saying that it's 500 plus or minus that spread? Because your peak is about 200.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry, I should have explained that. That is superposed epoch analysis of data that's very, very variable.
That's right.
So actually, the flow velocity varies on the scale you're able to observe it with, namely on the spin rate of the spacecraft. You need one spin to observe it. And it typically is variable between 5 to 10 seconds. So once you average it, the absolute magnitude here doesn't mean it. The real maximum is 500 to 1,000 kilometers per second. Again, some decent fraction of the available, of the local available. So what we have here, we just create the aurora and the subthermoelectric depth actually by these flows, originating from 20 to 25 RE, and when they pile up pressure gradients, when the flow is diverted close to 10 RE, you're creating these features which are seen on the ground. But before I come to the relation to aurora, let me give you some other rather new result And that is actually how wide are these slope tangents. That's difficult, because with one spacecraft you don't know. Are you just going on and off out of the slope channel, which is maybe very wide, and you're just going on and off vertically or whatever. But with cluster again, and there we use other data, plus a different separation, we can get at least some idea. And you can see, when you look at the gradient, dv divided by dy, or on the other hand, dz, so sinusally and vertically, change in velocity when you move sinusally, or you compare to cluster spacecraft separated sinusally, and same thing when you do that vertically. There's lots of things that can happen. It could be very close to zero, it can be 0.4, it can be 0.6, but if you calculate a median, the average, or whatever you want to do, you come up with the most probable value. And that is vertically something like about 1.5 to 2 RE widths. Taking that gradient and assuming you have a triangular shape, or you even assume that you have to start from the Albain velocity because you don't get the peak of the flow velocity and things like that. They all don't change very much. It's a width of 1.5 to 2 RE of that flow channel in the vertical direction. And if you look here, both curves, being on the northern or southern hemisphere, look still very much similar. If you do the same thing for the azimuthal extent, for the extending local time, then it gets more difficult. You see a clear difference whether you are on one side, on the dusk side, or whether you are on the dawn side. And actually, on the dawn side, the gradient is sharper. So the flow channel has a sharper gradient on the dawn side, and as we move through it, it's 2 to 3 RE. And this having a sharper gradient on the dawn side is very much known if you ever looked into the ionosphere somewhere. And you can even look at that picture. That's the dawn side, the aurora. It's a rather sharp gradient, if you think so. While if you look here, on the dusk side, if you look here on the dawn side, you would see it kind of diffusing out. Yeah, so I'm at my last subject, and that is a relation to aurora. It's not so easy to establish that relation, because you can see aurora using a polar imager, or whatever other it is, was a polar imager, use any other imager. It's fairly easy. They have a problem with sensitivity, sometimes they just don't observe it, but if they always look at the whole hemisphere. It's more difficult for a spacecraft, we use geothermal here, it was done by Nakamura and co-workers, and you may not just be in the right location to see it. So what she did is she looked at all real flow events, and actually she used the electric field greater than 2 millivolts per meter, because she was looking at different distances and changes, so that's a better parameter. And then she took all those events where she also had at least polar data available. And in any one of those, you could see right at the onset of that flow event or electric field enhancement, you could see auroral brightening. There were different types of one. One looked like it was substorm brightening, other like polar activations and things like that, but there was always something. And now the next thing was, okay, map the footpoint down to the ground, actually using the Tsiganenko model, but it turned out the Tsiganenko model wasn't good enough, as we all know. So she also worked together with Marina Kubishkina from St. Petersburg University, who does a kind of adaption of the Tsiganenko model using all other available data so that the field line tracing is better. That's what's used here. And you can see that you get the onset of auroral activation here, and you see flows typically before them. That's the argument whether the aurora comes before the flow or not. Flow comes before the aurora, as is reasonable, it's called the causal chain, at least for me, maybe not for all people. one thing, but you lose also the footprint to do something more. And the one thing is, the flow, of course, has an extent in east-west. Now we know it's 2 to 3 RE. At that time we didn't really know, but we also made a guess which also was reasonable for that. And that is, now you can look whether you are on the left-hand side or on the right-hand side. If you assume it's just time circular, you may assume as a triangular shape, whatever, if you just calculate the normal of the flow to the flow, to the flow front, just what is the normal when you see the flow first, then you know you are either on this side, the normal directing that, or on the other side. And so if you compare that, where are you? Positive values means you're west to the flow, negative values west to the flow, positive values east to the flow, I hope I'm right. Then you compare that to the foot point of your aurora, or the foot point of Diotel to where you see the aurora, the brightest spot, so to speak. And you can see it started the same way. The aurora is either at earlier local time or at later local time. But it's not centered around zero, but it's rather centered around roughly 1.4 hour of local time east of the aurora. And that is, and that there are other calculations like the 10, 45, 3 to 4, a bit less. But the thing is, essentially, if you see the flow here, you see the aurora here, to the west side. And if you have the kind of normal plasma bubble model, and you can always think about all these fast flow, these plasma bubbles, they have lower density and typically hotter plasma in there, then you would expect that you have upward filter line current. And it's the upward filter line current that creates the aurora. And I skip about the last one. Just come to the aurora.
So, comments? Yes.
Question, have you calculated the reconnection electric field for those events when you cross the X-type neutral line and compare that with V of N times B or something? You could do it, I guess. And even if you don't have the electric field directly measured, but in some cases you might have the direct measurements. Otherwise, you could calculate it from V cross V and then make the comparison.
Yeah, I'm not sure that V cross B would help. It's probably V cross B that
well,
would help.
Well, fortunately, the electric field extends over a wider region than the diffusion region,
no,
so
we,
you could.
We probably should do that. We haven't
done it yet. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Do you have some statistics of the electric current intensity? So you're saying you often observe the current intensity up to the 100 nanoampere per meter. That is very...
No, not often. I think we had, that was, actually that was a maximum.
Okay.
And we had just started to really assemble all the 2003 data, which gives you the best handle on the really real current density or maximum current density. We have done it with the 2001 data. But there, the scale is, you always average the current over 2,000 kilometers or something like that, so you automatically decrease the current density. And what we see, the typical value, just eyeballing it now, would be something of the order of 50 nanoamps per square meter. But we have no good statistics
yet. My
just
impression
now.
From geothermal data analysis is the average thin current city is about 10 to 20 nanoamps per meter. And that is almost scale of the ion inertia length. So if you often observe 50 or sometimes goes up to the 100, that means a very, very thin current is detected by the cluster satellite. So I'm really interested in looking at the statistics.
No, but we really have to do that. Actually, we had just surveyed, or let's say program surveyed, the data by looking at the very highest current densities, right? Because if you have small current densities, you never know, because curl of B may give you a value, but divergence of B may be as large as curl of B, and that means just your assumptions are wrong. So we have to do that, I'm sure, but we haven't done it.
I just want to mention that we did simulations of global simulation of thin crunches formation at the tail in response to southward turning, and even it was MHD but very high resolution, like 1/32 RE, and we see this triple peaks form.
Yeah.
And also even with framework of MHD, and also this interesting feature, I found that after southward turning, before actually near Earth line form, have flows earthward. Flows around 100, 200 kilometers prior to actual near-Earth reconnection, and it's caused by some sort of convection happened on the tail. And then it suddenly, within 10 minutes, it's becoming 500 to 1,000 when reconnection started. Could it be? Because I like your peak, you know, like 30 minutes prior to the peak.
I think it would be nice, but that peak hasn't really much to do with the southward turning leading to a substorm. We have seen lots of these fast flows without any real substorm activity on the ground. If you look carefully enough, you will always see a pseudo-onset. If you have a camera on the ground, the polar or all the images just can't see it. They are not sensitive enough. But if you look carefully, if you like look over Scandinavia, where they have a lot of old-spec cameras, or you do the same thing over Canada, where they have a lot of photometers and stuff like that, you see a one-to-one correspondence, even for all the events, but with the image you won't see it. But the substorm itself, there still must be some response, and I didn't have time this time to go into that, but the inner magnetosphere must respond differently, maybe even the tail, because it's related to southward turning, so the driving force is different, but that's not solved yet, unfortunately.
Thank you very much indeed. So now we have